Bharat Ratna, Nobel laureate, and one of the most respected public intellectuals and thinkers of our time, Professor Amartya Sen, is on the program. He's joining us from Harvard University to talk about demonetization and other issues grabbing the headlines. Thank you for your time, Professor Sen, and welcome to the program. I want to start by asking you to talk about what is occupying the debate in India for everyone. The Prime Minister's decision to demonetize the 500 and 1,000 rupee currency notes, taking 86% of the currency out of the market to tackle the problem of black money. Now, what is interesting is, despite the hardships, there seems to be actually a large measure of support among people for this move. In fact, the move is being lauded. How do you weigh in on this particular issue?
Well, I think the alleged objective of dealing with black money is something which interests all of us as Indians. It's not, you said, weighing in, and I think we Indians are all weighing in. We like that to happen. Along with that, we have to see whether this is a very good way of doing it, whether it is actually producing the results with less harm than would be inevitable. Unfortunately, that's not the case. We seem to be aiming at a minimal of achievement with a maximal of suffering connected with it. To start with, only a very small proportion of black money is held in notes. I think the former chief statistician, Pranav Sen, estimated about 6% of the black money. Even if we say 10%, it's a small fraction, much bigger amounts are held elsewhere in gold and other kinds of assets, and also accounts abroad, on which when the Prime Minister was fighting the election, he said he'll get them all back, and all of us Indians would get some bounty out of that in our account. That hasn't happened. And this is a relatively small fry in terms of dealing with black money. It's a small fry in terms of achievement, but it's a big, big disruptor of the economy. It creates particularly hardship for those who are not used to black money, who normal carry on normal trade, sell their fish in the market, sell other commodities, earn their income in some form, or housewives who keep their money in savings, in notes. And for them, an enormous problem. For those who are seasoned dealers of black money, they often tend to find their way out of these kinds of situations. So I think what you are noting, Barkha, is the fact that we Indians would like the government to do something about black money. We shouldn't hesitate on that. And yet we would like it to be intelligent and also humane. Intelligent in doing something which will have effect, and rather than something which has the appearance of an effect, and something which also is humane in not creating havoc in people's life, especially for those small traders and countrymen generally, not being declared as if they are black money dealers, allow them to carry on their legitimate business. That's the line that I think people could reasonably listen to. And no matter what the immediate enthusiasm or immediate denunciation is, and we have to take the politics away from the economics in thinking about that, we have to look at what the economic results are in this case and whether it's being achieved in the way that could have been achieved with less pain and much greater success.
Right, but Professor Sen, the words you've actually used, for example, speaking to the Indian Express, you said that the decision by the Prime Minister and the government was despotic. You used the word authoritarian. Now, you could have two views on the decision, but why this particular choice of words? Why such strong words?
Well, it's despotic in the sense that if a government promises, as any promissory note does, that when given to us, we will give you this amount of compensation for it. It's a promissory note. To break such a promise is a despotic action. Now, you know, I'm not a great admirer of capitalism, as probably people who have read any of my writings would know. On the other hand, capitalism has had many successes, and the successes have come from having a trust in business. And the roots of the trust is the faith in the promissory note. I promise to pay you this amount. Suddenly the government says, well, we did promise, but we are not going to pay you that amount. Well, that's a despotic action. It undermines the entire economy of trust. That's the sense in which it's despotic. It has legal aspects, which of course could be challenged in a court, but it, from my immediate point of view, it's an economic aspect. It's a disaster for an economy of trust, which makes a very big difference to the success of the Indian economy, which has been quite successful in terms of economic growth, though not in distribution, but economic growth for more than 20 years now. The country has been growing very fast. But it's all based on the acceptance of each other's words. And by taking a despotic action and suddenly saying, we have promised, but we won't fulfill our promise, you hit at the root of it. So despotism had its economic price, quite aside from its implications in terms of the harassment that is brought about by suddenly making normal, legitimate traders potential holders of black money, potential racketeers, until they can show that they are not racketeers after all.
Professor Sen, is it your argument that this demonetization will have very little impact on tackling black money, or is it your argument that the policy itself will actually hurt the economy? Because if you see the spectrum of opinions here, you have a Manmohan Singh who stood up in Parliament and said it would shave off 2% from the GDP. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have Anandan Nilekani, someone who was with the Congress himself, the architect of Aadhaar, really batting for this move, saying that it will be one step or many steps towards a cashless economy. So there is a bipartisan support. So I want to ask you, what is your primary objection? That it will not achieve its stated objective, or that it will harm the economy?
Well, I think it's both. Nandan is a very old friend of mine, and I admire his work very much. The point that he was making, I haven't seen his interview, but I've seen a report on it, is that instead of using cash, they will use bank accounts now. And one of the objectives, not the only objective, Aadhaar has many other uses. One of the uses was to allow people to use bank accounts. But I think what has to be added to the concerns that that Nandan expressed is that once you take a despotic action, like saying that currency notes, though they say, I promise, that promise will not be fulfilled, the same thing could be done about banks too. The government could issue an order today saying bank accounts over a certain amount would not be accepted. Now, until these people show that they are clean dealers, they are not racketeers, by undermining basic faith in the currency, which was, after all, the first thing that made capitalism move when it did came into the world and achieved many successes in terms of economic growth, by undermining that, you undermine all other things which turn on a promise being kept. And that applies to bank accounts as well. So the right now, the bank account is not under attack, but it could be once the government, once people come to accept that a government's promise means nothing. Now, I think this is serious, and it's not only the present government. I think the past government, when it suddenly decided to put tax on fast activities, I think made a big mistake, because people had been promised that issues had been cleared, and suddenly this was brought in. This will happen under the previous government's watch. Now, I think we have to dissociate the politics from the economics. In the economic point of view, going against going against past promises is a terrible way of running any system which depends on trust. And any economic system of dealing with each other, trust is really very centrally important. So there is that issue that remains. It may not come tonight, but it come any time, given the fact once a promissory note had been disallowed, we don't know where exactly it's going to stop. Now, as far as black money is concerned, as I was mentioning, it's a very small, fast portion of black money is held in the form of currency. Much higher proportion of normal persons' transactions, the results of selling commodities, whether it be fish or clothing or anything, or shoes, whatever it is, when the money comes, those are suddenly declared to be illegal unless it is shown to be the onus is on then the on the holder of the currency to show that it is white rather than black. Now, this actually undermines confidence in the economy very badly. Manmohan, who is also, of course, a very old friend of mine, was making the point that it disrupts the economy, and he's right there. I don't know whether the exact number he gave, 2% decline or something, is correct or not. I mean, he has worked on it, and I have not. But the point is there disruption? Yes. Is there potential danger of undermining confidence and the very basis of capitalism? Yes. Those of us who want to go beyond capitalism and want policies where public health care, public education are pursued by the government rigorously should be worried that the basic business principle of capitalism is being undermined. The answer is yes, because we do want the business success, along with the government doing its job in education and health care, rather than government not doing its job in education and healthcare and undermining the business that the private sector is doing. Yeah. So I think in terms of economic analysis, this is a pretty unfortunate move. There are very many things that the government can do, including bringing all these illegal money back from abroad, on which we were promised many things. Nothing has happened. And that's the contrast that one has to look at.
Right. But Professor Sen, Let me just give you a thought that one does hear from the supporters of the BJP again and again, and their suggestion is that many people who are coming out to criticize the demonetization policy are in fact doing so because they have always been opposed to Narendra Modi, or they have always been critics of Narendra Modi, and they have conflated their criticism of the BJP and Mr. Modi with their criticism of demonetization. And I ask you this because you have been a trenchant critic of Mr. Modi, and there could be supporters of the government who say that basically you've mixed up the two things, your criticism of Mr. Modi per se and demonetization.
No, I don't think, I don't know that argument, so I'm not very well able to respond to the question, other than saying that my critique of Mr. Modi was not connected with his wanting to get rid of black money. If he did it successfully, I would be full of admiration and applaud. My worry here is that the policy he has chosen would not do very much to reduce black money and do a great deal to disrupt the economy and make the life of ordinary law-abiding white money-holding citizens much harder. As far as the my critique of Modi is concerned, it's much more concerned related to taking the view of India that I take. It's for every Indian citizen, whether you're Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Parsi or what, and not to have favoritism of that, and also to have a system where the people are not harassed, suddenly not people are not described as being anti-national. On the basis of getting a 31% vote in the election, BJP may get a majority of the seats, but that does not give it the license to declare some people to be anti-national because they happen to disagree with the government.
Right. But fair enough, but one last question on demonetization and then we'll move on. And that question would be that, in fact, you've used such strong words like authoritarian and despot, a despotic move for this policy. But in fact, this has happened before in India, 1978, when demonetization did take place via an ordinance, of course, and ironically, the same Manmohan Singh was a bureaucrat in the finance ministry at that time. So there are those who would say that, you know, this has happened before. Why are you using these kind of sweeping adjectives this time?
Indeed, it happened before. If that was the argument, then I don't think we will move towards a democratic society where people's rights are respected. Lots of things have happened before which were terrible. People have been kept in prison for long periods, without being brought to justice. There were times, and this was in the Congress government, were members of political party. Communist Party members could not get a passport. There are lots of things that have happened in the past which we should not be proud of and which we should try to overcome. So authoritarianism is not judged by saying, is it unprecedented? Of course, it may not be unprecedented. Perhaps this particular step is unprecedented, And some may argue that it has certain amount of sting, which previous things didn't have. But I would say that the basic issue, that unprecedentedness, has got nothing to do with authoritarianism, cannot be overlooked. India has often, despite being a democratic country, being authoritarian again and again. And we should avoid that. And rather than avoiding it, if you intensify it, then it becomes really a serious question on the political front. I have been addressing demonetization on the economic front, but the authoritarianism is an important issue, as an Indian citizen who stand in queue in every country try to go into because of my citizenship for a long, long queue. I do that because I want to fight for our freedom, fight for equity, justice, and authoritarianism cannot be justified by saying, well, other people did it before.
Now, I want to move on to another issue in the headlines that would be of direct concern to you, and that is, of course, the Nalanda University in Bihar. We've seen the Chancellor, George Yeo, resign. He resigned in protest because the mentors group was changed, he said, without him being consulted. Now, you, of course, were dropped from that particular group, the governing board, 4 days before George Yeo then quits in protest. Your run-ins now with the government on Nalanda have been a matter of record. You would, of course, be upset with the latest development.
Well, I see it with the greatest of concern. Nalanda is one of the jewels of Indian history. We have to recognize we are a multi-religious country, and it was a Buddhist educational enterprise. It related closely to the Buddha's own idea of enlightenment, enlightenment for all people from everywhere. And we had students in Nalanda beginning from the 5th century onward, not only from India, but from China, Japan, Korea, and elsewhere. We have had a real tradition on that. And I see the decimation of that tradition with the greatest of concern. All the people who were involved in setting up this thing, with the exception of Mr. N.K. Singh, who has now moved from the JD affiliation to BJP, has survived, and it's good that he survived because he's at least one person who was involved when the Nalanda plans were being taken up. But now we have reached a state when, instead of being a whole monitoring board who were deeply involved with Nalanda and its issues, we have a basically bureaucratic committee. Now, there, some of them are very fine people, but they have not been connected with Nalanda in any particular way. We have to recognize several things. One, George Yeo was my successor. He was an outstandingly good chancellor. He spent a lot of time working for it. And his interest in Nalanda began earlier, even when I was the chancellor and he was a member of the board. So what happened is that a whole lot of people who were dedicated to doing something out of a very difficult exercise of rebuilding a university which had about 800 years of good run and then 800 years of being dead to bring it forward. And George Yeo, along with the work of the vice chancellor he deeply trusted and rightly, namely Dr. Gopal Sabharwal, were doing excellent work in rebuilding it. The government didn't like it. Government had to have its own way. It had to have its own vice chancellor. And now they will have an opportunity having its own chancellor. Mm-hmm. And educational institution after educational institution, this has happened. It happened in the universities, even having the Indian Council of Cultural Relations, Indian Council of Historical Research, the National Book Trust, and a lot of other things. The government have been putting their well-chosen, particularly partisan people, to run institutions. And this will now happen to Nalanda. And people might say, well, it's happening all over India. Why especially weep about Nalanda? Mm. Part of the reason, of course, I've been deeply connected with it from the age of 11. It was my dream to rebuild it. I still have a general dream of helping educational institutions and working for them as much as I can. And I still have Harvard, my Harvard base, my Trinity College Cambridge base, and so on. But the jewel of it, of course, was Nalanda, which we have been trying to build from scratch, because it had been dead for 800 years, and had great success. Of course, people were sometimes impatient of the slowness of the progress, but rebuilding a university without having a campus, which is still being built, it requires an amount of imagination, which is important, and Georgia was leading that tremendously well.
But may I ask you to respond to what the BJP has said about the entire controversy? When asked this question on Georgia's exit, the BJP actually said that his protest was strange because the Mentors group was actually created with a one-year tenure, and it's converted itself into this governing board, self-created governing board, said the BJP's Ram Madhav. In other words, this was a group whose time was meant to be up after 1 year in any case. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I respond to it too by pointing out what the facts are. Of course, it was the Nalanda Mentor Group. It wasn't that the Nalanda Mentor Group converted itself into the governing body. It didn't have the power to do so. It's the Indian Parliament. It's the Parliamentary Act that was passed. The Parliamentary Act had certain defects, and it was placed to the Parliament by the then government and the then Ministry of External Affairs without consulting the board, which was a mistake. As a result, a number of mistakes lingered on in that. As a result, the government found itself in a quandary. First, the previous government, the UPA government, and then later on the BJP government, they had to continue with the board because there were certain difficulties in the act. It's not the responsibility of the Nalanda Mentor Group to set itself up. But of course it was always known that when there would be a board, they would not get people who had got nothing to do with Nalanda to run the university. I mean, as a institutional entity, the Nalanda Mentor Group should have dissolved, of course, and there should have been a board. I would imagine people like Giorgio, Wang Gangwu, Nakanishi, these people would be in the board, appointed by the government. Instead of that, the government is saying the Nalanda Mentor Group as an institution should have been dissolved much earlier. Of course it should have been. The reason it wasn't done is because there was a bungling at the bureaucracy level of the Ministry of External Affairs, so that they produced an act without consulting the Nalanda Mentor Group, creating a problem which made it difficult for them to appoint a new board. Now, when they did make an appointment of a new board, they chose to exclude all the people with the exception of the member of BJP, Mr. N.K. Singh. It was all done in a way that seemed to think that knowledge of Nalanda, involvement with Nalanda, understanding of the commitment of Nalanda didn't make any difference. That's where the issue is.
One last question on Nalanda, Professor Sen. The fact of the matter is that the BJP has said that these were decisions taken by the president himself, Pranab Mukherjee, who is, of course, in his capacity as visitor of the university. Would you, through this interview, want to say something to President Mukherjee, maybe make an appeal to him of some kind? Because, of course, it is hurtful for you to see the university embroiled in this kind of controversy, something that even George, you referred to. But again and again, in some ways, we are told these were the president's decisions. And therefore, my question to you is, what would you say to the president? Would you ask President Pranab Mukherjee to intervene and save Nalanda University from getting trapped in the binaries of the kind of controversies it's trapped in?
You see, I think this has been a subject of considerable debate. One of my students gave me the entire many, many volume proceedings of the Constituent Assembly. The question had come up again and again: does the president act only on the advice of the ministry, or does the president, can the president apply some judgment? Now, some past presidents, Narayanan, for example, has actually exercised their own judgment, certainly asked the government often, are you sure you want to do it? Could you reconsider it? And sometimes they've actually gone little against the ministry's position. Now, there have been lawyers who have discussed it. Fali Nariman spoke about the state of the nation going to that question. Now, I think the present president, Pranab Mukherjee, who I've known for a long time, has decided that he clearly, judging from his issues he is taking, what is, decisions he is taking, that he would be guided by the government. Now, you may say that, why are you assuming that he didn't want to dismiss you anyway? Possibly he did want to dismiss me, but I tend to imagine, since I also have had conversations with him other times, that there wasn't a rot there that would naturally translate itself in this form. And certainly, since he was also present in the time of the convocation, the first convocation of Nalanda University, he gave a wonderful speech in defense of academic freedom. So I take it that somewhere in his heart, the importance of academic freedom must be there. But then there is the issue, does he act entirely on the command of the government? Now, this is something where the present president will establish, I think, precedences. And I teach a little law. I'm also a member of the law faculty here, in addition to economics and philosophy. In fact, I'm teaching a course on law, on democracy and rights right now, with my colleagues at Harvard. The precedences of this kind are very important. What the present president does would be seen by later presidents as to whether they simply follow what the government does, or whether the president, as someone of great stature, exercises his or her own judgment in dealing with this issue. We're all watching that. I'm not urging him to do anything. This is not my role. This is for the president to reflect and decide on. There are much bigger issues also where the president may have to reflect as to whether this is the appropriate thing to do, what the government is asking, or what a request is coming from, whether there be president's rule in Uttarakhand or anything else. These are issues for the president to reflect. And of course, since we live in a democracy, we have rules, and we recognize and respect the decisions that are taken by the government. But if the argument there is that the ministry wants something, then for the ministry to say, we have nothing to do with it, it's the president's decision, I think that is extremely unfortunate.
Right, Professor Sen. As I said, President Mukherjee will indeed, I'm sure, reflect on your words after he hears and watches this interview. Thank you so much, Amartya Sen, for joining us from Harvard University on The Buck Stops Here.
Thank you very much.